This whole thing for me is about creating more economic opportunity and jobs globally, because that's, you know, that's what I really believe is that's what this will do. Because ultimately, every new entrepreneur who creates a great service has to have the money to do it.
Absolutely.
And so fintech is going to touch everything.
You are listening to Hooked on Startups, where every week you'll hear from some of the most talented, inspiring, and successful entrepreneurs who share their real life stories, how they overcame challenges and failures, and how they mastered success. Get ready for some of the best business tips, tricks and tactics, and some frank, unscripted discussions. Here's your host, Matthew Sullivan.
Today on Hooked on Startups, I am delighted to have none other than Jason Best on the show. Jason, welcome to Hooked on Startups.
Thank you so much for having me today.
Well, I'm going to try and explain to people a tiny snapshot of what you've done and how important your role has been as one of the creators of crowdfunding. So currently you're the entrepreneur in residence at UC Berkeley. You're a co-founder and principal of Crowdfund Capital Advisors. And you are one of a handful of people. Was it just three people, I think, who co-authored the crowdfunding investment framework, which eventually became the Jobs Act, which was signed off in April 2012. So you were one of the people there in the Rose Garden watching Barack Obama signing off effectively something that you had created. So it's you know, not very often that we have such change makers on the show. So so you've spoken at the White House, TEDx, the World Bank Global Forum. You're the co-author of Crowdfunding Investing for Dummies. So that must have been fun writing that. So you are clearly one of the foundations, one of the cornerstones of what we know today as crowdfunding. So as the chief exec and founder of Crowd Venture, thank you very much for helping me get into business.
You bet. Well, thanks a lot for having me. I think that, you know, it took a lot of work from a lot of people to get the Jobs Act passed, and we kind of worked on our slice of it. And certainly my co-founders, Sherwood Neese and Zach Cassidy-Dorian, the other two co-authors of the crowd investing framework, it was a lot of energy and a lot more time spent in Washington, D.C. than I ever thought I would spend.
Yeah, I really want to get into the behind-the-scenes stories there, but we'll do that in a minute. But let's just explain what crowdfunding is, because I think there's a lot of interpretations, but really the best way to describe crowdfunding, how would you describe crowdfunding?
So the origins of crowdfunding were really, the origins of crowdfunding in general predate my involvement in the space. My involvement in the space began around the area of crowdfund investing, so the equity and debt portions of crowdfunding. Crowdfunding was born actually when artists and other creators were looking for ways to fund their projects. And then we're looking for ways, if I can make this art, will you buy it in advance and I can give you some rewards in exchange. And so it was basically, you know, instead of waiting till the end of the process to pay, you pay at the beginning and then get a reward at the end. And it started out, you know, Kickstarter and Indiegogo were the first two crowdfunding platforms and, you know, began with creators, filmmakers and artists. But soon enough, entrepreneurs who were looking for capital to start their ideas found out about this great idea to actually, you know, use this new method of fundraising where you would use an online platform to connect, you know, potential contributors and entrepreneurs. And, you know, the magic in the bottle began to happen. I mean, the ability for people to connect both intellectually and emotionally using the web, using video and text, and the ability to connect with people who are part of their community. And I think one of the things people think about with community and crowdfunding, community is not just a physical geographic community. Communities are also, you have communities of geography, communities of origin, communities of diaspora, communities of interest. And crowdfunding allows you to connect, you know, via the web and social media to people who are interested in what you're doing and want to support that.
Thank you. And I think the critical difference, so when we talk about rewards-based crowdfunding, we're really talking about Kickstarter and Indiegogo. Those are the two major providers. So in other words, if you have a product or, as you say, with Indiegogo, some art, for example, that you want to pre-sell, the moment, however, that you step into selling shares in a company, then you step into the remit of the various
whole new world.
So, and I think that's really the biggest challenge you know, back in you know, 2010, 2011, when you probably started this.
Yep, that's what we're trying to solve for. I mean, it all started at a friend's wedding. And I and my co-founder, Sherwood Neese, were talking about this lack of access to capital in the wake of the financial crisis.
Yeah.
And the fact that, you know, there's just, personally speaking, I mean, I live and work in San Francisco, which is one of the deepest pools of capital in the world, but I'm from a small town in Louisiana. So, you know, understanding very, very, you know, viscerally the fact that most entrepreneurs and small business owners just don't have access to capital. And we just wondered if you can give away money on Kickstarter, if you can lend money to entrepreneurs in developing countries like through Kiva,
yep.
Why can't you invest in businesses you use every day or in entrepreneurs you believe in? And so our goal was really to go about how do we change that? And that's the path we started in August of 2010.
But again, to take on the SEC or to take on legislation that has been enshrined for 78 years, you know, which is, you know, this legislation was enacted, you know, post the Great Depression. So it was really enacted to protect individual investors. So you're up against something that's been entrenched in the legal system for 78 plus years.
Yep.
How do you begin doing something like that? And that is very relevant for today as well, because as we'll talk about later, I hope, there's all sorts of changes that are continuing and challenges to securities legislation. So how did you find the first step to be able to engage the SEC with this idea?
The two most important elements to get started are naivete and stupidity. and we had ample amounts of both when we began. And honestly, it's not knowing what you're going into. I mean, understanding that this is a big challenge, understanding, okay, changing law is a big deal, but really, not understanding that it would ultimately take, you know, over 4 years to do. You know, the fact that at the beginning, to get the law changed was between our first trip to Washington and being in the Rose Garden with President Obama was 460 days of active work on that process.
Which is what, a year and
like 14 months, 15 months.
Which doesn't sound a terribly long time. So clearly there was obviously an enormous amount of work from your part, but there seemed to be a receptive audience to be able to get that sort of change through. Is that, and did you find tensions within the old school and the new school, as it were?
Right. Well, there was no new school. It was just us. We were the only new school kids there.
Slightly outnumbered, 3-2.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, it was pretty funny. We definitely ran up, you know, the first meeting we had was with a gentleman who ran the small business division of the Securities and Exchange Commission.
Yeah.
And he politely thanked us for our ideas and told us that he wasn't going to the SEC just doesn't make those kind of changes, that it requires an act of Congress, yep. Which is a great way of getting us out of his office. So we, you know, again, naivete and stupidity, decided to go and start talking to people in Congress about, in their offices, about, you know, this idea to create jobs, to create more opportunities for innovation and more opportunities for entrepreneurship.
Yes.
And so we had a lot of good luck and a lot of good timing. Because at that moment, you know, you're thinking about that we're still getting over the global financial crisis. And Washington was desperate to find something they could show they were doing to help small business and to help people to recover from this, you know, national global tragedy. And so this was something, this was an idea that did not cost the government any money, that aligned with very much what we would say, you know, mom and apple pie sort of ideas here in the U.S., of entrepreneurship, innovation, and you know, so small business.
Yeah.
And we were able to you know, answer a lot of questions. So it was a very iterative process. We created our first framework of what we thought would be important to use to create the Jobs Act. And then that 460-day process was a very long sales cycle where we had to iterate and sell and resell and repackage and reposition these ideas and grow these ideas to grow our following and this idea that this could actually work, that you actually could allow retail investors to make investments in a regulated way in small businesses and startups.
And so the output of that, or the outcome of that, I mean, we had April 2012 was the signing of the Jobs Act, which stands for Jumpstart Our Business Startups Act. And I think really where we are today, so we're 5 years on, how has it developed compared to how you hoped or wanted it to develop in terms of the execution of the Jobs Act?
So in the Jobs Act, it was mandated, in quotes, that all the provisions were to be live and enforced and available to people to use within 180 days of President Obama signing it. That didn't happen.
No.
The SEC, these are really, which demonstrates what a big change this was. I mean, this is one of the biggest changes in SEC regulation in as you say, 80 years, nearly 80 years.
Yeah.
And so the SEC moved very slowly. And so what we did, we obviously didn't just go home and hope for the best. We stayed engaged. Yeah. And so we worked very closely with the SEC over the course of the 4 years it took to get all the major, the three major provisions of the Jobs Act enacted. Or as I like to call them, the three kind of flavors of crowdfunding.
Yeah.
And because we had to present, I mean, our first meeting at the SEC, we were asked to create the Industry Trade Association here in the United States by the White House, because they, you know, government needs the trade association to engage with in order to have a dialogue. It's uncomfortable. Governments are uncomfortable having individual company dialogues.
Yep.
And so we created the trade association, and then those representatives went to the SEC for our first group meeting after the signing. And there were about, you know, eight of us from the industry, and then there were, you know, about probably 20 SEC attorneys in the room.
Okay.
And, you know, all trying to figure out what this was about and who we were and what they were going to have to deal with. And at the time, I mean, we were just trying to figure out, like, where were they in the understanding and adoption curve of social media, which is obviously a key part of crowdfunding. And, you know, when we asked which one of you, this is 2012.
Yeah.
How many of you have Facebook accounts? No one was willing to say, raise their hand. And when we asked for LinkedIn accounts, it literally were a half a dozen hands that went up.
Yeah.
And so we had a lot of education to do over the course of 4 years to really help people understand how this was going to be used, why these were not boiler rooms, and why this was different from the kind of opacity of the markets in the past.
Yeah. And since then, I mean, there are not so much conflicting figures, but the World Bank, I was reading a report earlier today, the World Bank report that I read now reckons that crowdfunding investment market is projected to hit $93 billion by 2025. So the market that you've created, and I guess a large percentage of that is going to come from US activity. So what you've done is you've created something that really has been a huge success and is really the beginning of an unraveling of legislation that is decades old. And do you find, or have you seen with the research that you've done, that there is real demand from investors to be able to participate in these offerings through these crowdfunding mechanisms?
Yes, there is demand. And I think, and we can talk about it later, but I mean, I think some of the froth in the ICO market is demonstration of that. But you know, our what we've seen in the crowdfunding market in the other countries, because I mean, actually the UK took a very different approach to allowing crowdfunding, and the UK, in my mind, is the leading online finance debt and equity crowdfunding market in the world, most innovative, most engaged, and I think just really kind of years ahead of where we are in the US, and that's because the regulator took a very different approach to this, one of a collaboration rather than, you know, sort of adversarial relationship.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I want to say, I guess I'll say this too. I mean, over the course of the 4 years, we have been able to build very collaborative, very strong relationships with the SEC. And they understand, you know, who the good actors are now in the space. And they've been good partners. I think that but obviously, as the biggest economic, you know, financial market in the world, they tend to move more cautiously than smaller, more nimble markets that have more room to experiment to try to kind of, you know, jumpstart their growth. And so, you know, it's just really our work globally with other regulators has been different than in the work that we've done in the U.S. just because we have to, you know, we're meeting different challenges and different needs and different opportunities.
So do you think that the SEC's pathway really has been deliberately reserved in the sense that they've said, okay, well, we'll allow this to go through, we'll provide access through the various titles, through the three flavors, as you say. But, you know, before we really get behind this, we want to see some sort of results. We want to give it some time behind the wheel, as it were. So do you think that the SEC now are becoming much more open to enhancements. For example, the definition of an accredited investor, which has been one of the real frictions for selling through crowdfunding platforms, because you're limited to accredited investors. I mean, do you see some avenues where the SEC will become more flexible?
Well, there's definitely a proposal now to broaden those accredited investor definitions that, you know, we've worked on for years now, because it's been our belief since the beginning that, you know, there are a lot of people who are educationally accredited or occupationally accredited, and so they should have the opportunity to make these investments on their own, because they are able to do that. I think that we will get those expansions in the accredited investor rule over time. I'm hopeful that'll happen in the next, you know, year or two. But I mean, I have no inside knowledge on that to let me know when that prediction is going to happen. But I do think that, you know, the data that's coming out of regulation crowdfunding or Title III crowdfunding is a very robust data set, because that's what we wanted to have, a robust data set in the legislation, because we wanted to be able to prove our thesis that this was and it could be an effective way to raise capital, and it would not be a scam fest.
Yeah. So Title III, I think, really is the purest form of crowdfunding, because could you just give us a tiny bit of background about Title II and Title IV, and how it's crowdfunding, but not really Title III? And then I'd like to really spend a bit of time exploring Title III, what that means, and how important that is from a company's perspective to be able to raise capital.
Sure. So the first Title II was the first piece of the Jobs Act that was enacted about 3 years ago, and that enabled accredited investors to be solicited publicly, for you to be able to, instead of just having to go out to raise money from people you already had pre-existing relationships, for you to be able to publicly solicit for private securities. But the restriction on that came in the requirement that you couldn't just check a box to say you're accredited, but that you had to actually demonstrate to a third party that you had means that met the test, meaning over $1 million of a liquid net worth, excluding the value of your home, or income of over $200,000 per year for the prior 2 years. And so those tests can now be managed through a number of different, you know, technology platforms, but that was what was added to make Title II work.
So Title II really was it was a give and take. It was a give. In other words, what you can now do is really advertise your offering without restriction, as you rightly say. But beforehand, you couldn't do that. However, if you want someone to sign up on your platform, you have to get their CPA or their attorney or someone to prove, or they've got to send in your tax return. So that acted as a real dampener. So almost that was the false start. And then Regulation A+, which is the hammer to crack the walnut, as it were, that came out about 18 months, 2 years ago.
Right. And so that enabled you to raise. There are two tiers of Regulation A+, but really the tier that most people focus on is Tier 2, meaning the ability to raise up to $50 million from both accredited and unaccredited investors in the same vehicle.
And I think there's a fair amount of excitement over Regulation A+, because that is it's all horses for courses, but that's a very useful container or mechanism to enable companies to raise money, because there's a direct pathway to NASDAQ or to the OTC markets. And I think there's a real success story recently with a car manufacturer that raised $19 million successfully. And so that's seen as, I think that's a real success story. So, but the thing that is most in tune with the real initial beliefs, I guess, behind your crusade, if you don't mind me calling that, is Title III, which is the ability for startups, which is effectively the name of the legislation. So Title III, is that what you're sort of most focused on now?
I mean, we're focused on, I mean, the focus we have in our global advisory practice is pretty broad. It's really kind of in fintech innovation and how to think about it from a regulatory as well as an investor and a fintech, a technologist perspective. And so we kind of provide advice to kind of all three parts of the wheel, if you will, that makes it go. But certainly the work that we did at the beginning was very focused on how do we get more money to startups and small businesses. And so when you sit in Silicon Valley, people scoff at $1 million, like it's not enough money to be worth doing. In most parts of the country, $1 million is still a lot of money.
Absolutely.
To most small businesses, that's you know, plenty of money to expand operations, hire more people, increase inventory. And so we think that it's still a very viable opportunity.
And do you find that there's this misunderstanding that a startup has to be a Silicon Valley tech company?
Sure.
And is that something that you've helped explode that myth?
Well, I think we're trying to help explode that myth. It hasn't exploded yet. We've got more work to do. But I think that most people focus on, you know, Silicon Valley tech company, you know, Facebook and Uber. And those are all possibilities. I think the two things I guess I would say is, number one, the reason Silicon Valley is what it is because this is where the money is. And so the people who need the money come to where the money is to find the money, right? What we're trying to do with crowdfunding is say, look, if you want to come to Silicon Valley, do it. But maybe you have a great idea and you've built a team and you want to build a business in Kansas City or in Atlanta or in Austin. There's no, you know, then do so and you could find capital in those places as well. That's the opportunity we're trying to ignite, is to say, we don't just have to have two or three tech centers in this country. We could have, you know, 50. And then on the flip side of it, the small business side, just to finish that out.
Yeah.
You know, the small business, traditional small business, I mean, that's where we think debt crowdfunding or revenue-based crowdfunding has a huge opportunity.
Well, that's really what I was leading on to, because I think there's a real feeling that anything to do with seed funding or startup capital has to be to a tech company whose sole objective is to become the next unicorn. And there's this feeling that still permeates, I think, a lot of the companies that are trying to raise capital, that if they're trying to build a business that is outside of tech, that they still have these huge challenges in getting the seed capital off the ground. Right. So is it an educational process that you find that you're up against as well, trying to let people know that if they have a business that is not tech, that crowdfunding is for you as well?
Absolutely. I mean, we work very closely with an organization called the Small Business and Entrepreneurship Council, which is probably as close to a, you know, lobbying organization as that small business has in Washington, D.C., and Karen Kerrigan, the one who runs that organization, is a great advocate for small businesses and startups. And so many of her 100,000 plus members are traditional small businesses who need capital. And so helping to get the word out, you know, in with different chambers of commerce, with, you know, small business organizations, with entrepreneurship groups locally, is really, really important. And because these are new tools. The other reason, honestly, that we've noted, one of the reasons why this hasn't, and there are a lot of people who thought this was going to take off like a rocket ship on day two, right?
Yeah.
And it hasn't. And frankly, I'm glad, because if it had, then everyone would be talking about Dutch tulip bulbs.
Yeah.
And everyone would be talking about this as being, you know, a crazy town. And people didn't know what they were doing. But because it's taken off slowly, because it's been regulated.
Yeah.
And the other reason is because attorneys and accountants have to know what this is before they're going to allow their clients to use it. And so, you know, that one of the reasons why most of these financial tools, there's like a slow growth for the first 2 years.
Yeah.
After year two, you begin to see a bend in the curve. And after 3 years, you see a bigger bend in the curve.
Yeah.
And the adoption, because frankly, the enablers of these tools, accountants and attorneys and other, you know, investment bankers and other people, begin to understand what these are, how they're used, who's appropriate for these, each of the individual tools, so they can then be used. And so that's how we think that's going to grow.
Yeah, and I think we've seen that with, certainly with crowdfunding today, because we've seen that particularly with Regulation A+, because there's much more disclosure with Regulation A+, and you get to see that it's a bigger ticket, there's more money raised. And we're beginning to see the pathway where people have raised money through Regulation A+, and they've gone on to exit through IPOs on NASDAQ or through the OTC. But just to recap, so Title III, which is what we're talking about, is the pure crowdfunding essence, as it were, which is the ability to raise up to $1 million from non-accredited, so pretty much from anybody in the US. Okay. Now, do you find that people still have challenges? So even though that ability to raise capital there, the machinery is there, what you've also done is you've created a whole fintech industry around that. So did you realize that when you were watching Barack Obama sign in April 2012, that you'd also create a almost like a service industry? So I think you can quite easily put your hand up and say that you were one of the founders of the fintech.
Well, maybe a tiny slice of it. I think we didn't know. The answer is no, we didn't have any idea that this was all going to happen. I think over the course of the lobbying effort, and certainly during the work with the SEC post Jobs Act signature, what we did realize was that there was going to need to be, you know, that just like any financial market, it doesn't just, you know, when you talk about buying and selling on NASDAQ,
yeah,
I mean, if you actually drew out the whole ecosystem of companies and services and people that have to be involved in trading one share of stock between one buyer and one seller, you know, probably a dozen entities between that process. And that's because of the, you know, the requirements for disclosure, transparency, trust, data analysis, and data integrity, and all those things. And so we just have to create those in the new space, because the cost structures to deliver those centralized services through public exchanges are very high. And just like with other centralized services that have now been decentralized in the rest of our economy, you know, travel, advertising, other places where we decentralize markets, the financial markets being decentralized. And so now we have to have these different constellation of services that have to be recreated using technology, using lower cost structures so that they can be used on a more broad basis.
Some of the data that you've seen, because you part of your the services that your company provides, it really is to track the data. So you have very much the inside track on what's happening. So what important data points are you seeing coming out of Title III now that it's been running for sort of two, three years?
Well, Title III has been running for about 15 months, like 16 months now. And it's been fascinating. I think that, so there've been about 500 companies in 38 states that have, launched campaigns to raise capital. And that's pretty exciting. I think that, you know, obviously we've seen a lot of activity in California, New York, and Texas. It's not surprising, having tech centers in New York City, Austin, Texas, and, you know, San Francisco and LA. But we now are seeing that really it's now moving across the entire country, and there's only a handful of states that have not had a chance to launch at least one campaign. So that's great, because, you know, what we've seen is that it really is, number one, you know, your social network matters.
Yeah.
That you can't just show up at a crowdfunding platform, make a video, and expect the capital to just appear magically. That this is seed and series A type capital, which means you're going to need to tap your own network and leverage your relationships. And so relationships matter, social network matters, your business proposition matters, that the crowd doesn't just throw money at everything, that you've got to demonstrate why you're worthy of investment. That people don't, you know, me contributing to your Kickstarter campaign for $100 because I think that your movie sounds really interesting is one thing. But you asking me to write a $1,000 check is entirely different. That's a different pocket I'm giving you money out of. That's my investment profit, not my donation pocket.
Yeah.
And so, you know, interestingly enough, about 300 people in each of these Title III campaigns. Typical check size now, when we began, interestingly enough, it was about $700 was the average investment per person. Now, 16 months later, it's about $1,000.
Wow, okay.
As a point of comparison, in the UK, where they've had retail investor crowdfunding for years now, it's about the equivalent. It's £2,500, or maybe $3,200, right? Sure. So more experience, more examples of success, more opportunities to have exits, then people are more game for making larger investments.
And also, I think it's probably quite pleasing to you to see the fact that people are holding back, where what you've done is you've created this mechanism to enable people to fund these companies that didn't happen before because of the legislative processes.
Yeah, look, I mean, we wanted to, I mean, if we thought we could have gotten more than $1 million in Title III as a cap through, we probably would have done it. But $1 million was really where we thought that was the sweet spot.
Yes.
And certainly, I'm all in favor of raising that limit to $5 million. And I think that once we have some more data, and I'm not sure how many more months of data we'll need, but once we have some more data, we can demonstrate that there is, you know, appetite, that the fraud, the, you know, the widespread fraud, or even, you know, small scale fraud hasn't occurred yet.
Yeah.
Knock on wood. And that, you know, that this is a responsible market that's growing responsibly.
Okay. So that is great news, because clearly the investing audience is not just parting with cash because they think it's the next big thing, which is going to go away. But having said that, what we've seen in just a few months into this, well, very early on this year, this tsunami of investing coming in through initial coin offerings. So completely out of left field, we're seeing over $1 billion of investment so far this year through an entirely or a quasi unregulated market, which is the ability to raise capital through issuing tokens in cryptocurrencies. So how do you see those two the dynamics of these two markets. You've got crowdfunding on one side, which is controlled, structured, regulated, effective, efficient, and is growing at a manageable rate. And then you have this sort of wild child out in the corner. How do you see that those two sort of developments working together?
So I might be slightly controversial in saying I think that crowdfunding and ICOs are two sides of the same coin.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just using the same tools, the same processes, the same technologies, more or less. The currency is different, but almost everything else is the same. And so I do think that, you know, and also we can talk, I guess, broadly speaking, ICOs are, it's just, you know, it's another flavor of crowdfunding, and it's just using different currency. I think that they, over time, will become a legitimate part of the market. I think that there are legitimate companies out there today that are raising money through ICOs. I'm biased because I'm an advisor to one of them that I think is a legitimate company that's just raised a significant amount of money through an ICO yesterday. But I think that, you know, there's also a lot of scam artists. There's also a lot of companies that are just a hope and a dream, and that are raising really huge amounts of money based on air.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we will have some significant short-term pain in the ICO market. And I think that, but long-term, will people use blockchains and virtual currencies to raise capital for their businesses? Absolutely.
And I think what you were talking earlier about the decentralization of some of the components of the capital raising process. So if we talk about the blockchain, and again, these are all words that are, they feel like buzzwords, but do you get the feeling that once the dust has settled, once the initial honeymoon period of the ICOs has gone away, and once we've flushed out the scam artists and there's been a few people sent to jail, which inevitably will happen, that the alternative currencies and this, the method of decentralizing fundraising, is that something that you find exciting? Because do you see that as a natural development of what you set in motion 5 years ago?
I think that the core idea of the decentralization and the ability to raise capital, you know, in a more efficient way is right. And there's something there, right? There's an opportunity there. I just think that it's, you know, we just have to build up the, you know, the superstructure around that to allow it to happen in a more structured way. I mean, the fact that it was pretty, what's pretty amazing to me is if ICOs had occurred and there had never been a Jobs Act, the SEC would have just said that they are illegal, period, yeah, point blank. The way they said that equity crowdfunding was illegal before the Jobs Act.
Understood.
But because we had the Jobs Act, it enabled there to be a release valve for the SEC to use to be able to say, okay, if you follow, you know, one of these exemptions, it's called out in the Jobs Act, then you can raise money through an ICO because it is a security. Because ICOs, there's the utility tokens, we can have that conversation, but we're talking, but you know, these investment contributions, it's an investment, it's a security, and it should be regulated.
So, and again, that's a very critical point. So talking specifically, you're talking about the, I suppose it's the Title II element, where if you are providing securities exclusively to accredited investors, is that what you're referring to, the ability to leverage parts of the Jobs Act in an ICO world?
Yeah, I mean, or you could even, you could have $1 million of it being raised through Title III through an ICO. As long as you're stipulating how you're going out to the market, because we're also seeing a lot of parallel offerings now.
Yes.
Where people are, you know, Title II and Title III, same terms to the two different audiences. And they've really been very effective.
And with your, obviously you have I'm imagining a red phone in your office, which is the hotline to the SEC, the bat phone style thing. But are you contacted regularly by the SEC to say, you know, Jason, what is your view on this? Because I guess it's happened so quickly and with such volume, it must have been a real, it's very difficult for them to react in a way. So are there a lot of wheels turning at the SEC trying to figure out how to manage this in the best interest of the investor and in the best interest of promoting capital growth?
The fact that the SEC issued an advisory letter a few weeks ago demonstrates how seriously they're taking it, because they were silent for a long time. I can't really get into all the, you know, sort of back and forth that we have with different folks in DC on the legislative branch and other places, but there's a lot of concern. and a lot of focus. And frankly, in other countries we work in as well. We've worked in over 40 countries now. And so there's a lot of interest there also in just trying to figure out how they can protect people. I think the fact that you've seen, you know, US, China, Hong Kong, Singapore all come out very strongly, you know, kind of trying to clamp down on these, I think will definitely help put the brakes on a lot of this. And I think that, you know, helping those countries to figure out how to put in place a framework to enable those to happen in a more structured format, they can still retain the innovation, the liquidity, the decentralization, but just some tracking and understanding to allow some transparency is really, really important.
Yeah. And so I guess really it's almost like, it was the lull, the crowdfunding legislation was the lull before the storm. So the last sort of 3 to 5 years has given everyone that, it's a bit like training wheels, I guess.
It opened the door to more innovation because there had been basically no innovation in that kind of how do you raise capital space for, you know, nearly 80 years.
And so going forwards, I mean, cryptocurrencies are decentralized, they're independent of currency, independent of governments. And it's pretty scary just to, you know, imagine that because of the lack of control. But if you were to fast forward to 5 years from now, which is always a very difficult question, how do you see the landscape for startup companies wanting to raise capital? How do you see it change from where it is today?
I think that you will see, I think number one, that we'll have a $5 million cap on Title III, I think in 5 years or less. I think that we will have also maybe some additional, we'll have an accredited investor rule change to enable more people to be investors. I think that we will have globally, you know, that's kind of the micro at the US level. I think you'll see, you know, all 50 states having had successful companies. We will have had successful exits through the three different flavors of crowdfunding within 5 years. Globally speaking, that's where like this massive opportunity exists, especially in developing economies. I mean, the World Bank research that we did that created that $93 billion number was really trying to address that. You know, how do we create a regulatory framework and a process to enable developing economies to, you know, create these, you know, these structures for themselves, because that's where it's, you know, incredibly broken, the access to capital. And so as we get, you know, trust and transparency tools, data and analytics services, you know, and other sorts of, you know, blue sky innovation are created in this space, that's how we'll get more funding for small businesses and startups. The other thing I'll just say to close out is that in 5 years, you will have mid to large size businesses who are also utilizing these types of tools to raise capital. I think that, you know, it's because they will find that for project-based funding, like if I'm, this is an extreme example, but, you know, if I'm Nike and there's a team inside of Nike that has a shoe, particular shoe they want to raise, or there's, you know, a brand extension or a new player or new opportunities, the ability to turn fans into investors, you know, is a really powerful thing because there's nobody that's going to support you more than an investor.
And I think that's something that's really come out as being one of the primary learnings of the Jobs Act and Title III, but also of what's happened with cryptocurrencies in the last 9 months, is the strength of the brand and the tribe effect. In other words, where a number of these token offerings have become successful because there is a big group of people, there's a community that very much believe in what that company is trying to do. So it goes beyond, I mean, there's a lot of speculation as well, but if you discount that, what you were saying earlier about the importance of community and the ability for companies to raise money from their fan base and for their fans, for want of a better word, to have a stake in the company that they support, that seems to be the message that is coming out loud and clear, which is why there is so much support for something that seems very intangible. And is that something that you're seeing outside of the US?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think that, you know, there are, we, you know, all the countries we work in, we meet incredible entrepreneurs who are trying to do really interesting things. And some of those people are trying to create fintech in their own country. And while some fintech is transportable across borders and enables that to happen, other fintech solutions, because of the uniqueness of each country, are going to have to create locally. And so we see that opportunity. But what we really want to see is the creation of these new tools that enable, you know, investors and entrepreneurs to meet online, to be able to you know, make a fair determination of his deal to do, and then and to do those deals.
Absolutely. So it's the strength of communities. It's the communities that you're building through this change in legislation is the most interesting thing I think that we've seen, is particularly if you layer on social media and the ability for to people to create and build communities, and then to and then you layer on the layers of trust as well, which an efficient blockchain theoretically could enhance the trust element by removing some trust requirements. So
absolutely.
So do you sort of have time to sleep at night, for example, or I guess this thing is this, like, you know, it's this tiger by the tail, really.
Yeah, no, it's drinking from a fire hose. You know, all the old catchphrases apply. I spend lots of time on airplanes, and it's super exciting because there's just a lot of things happening in this space, and it's the creation of a whole new industry.
Yes,
and it's been fascinating now to see, 5 years ago, sophisticated investors scoffed at the idea of retail investors ever having the ability to determine how to make investments into startups and small businesses. Now you see some very prominent VCs here in Silicon Valley acknowledge the fact that there's a role to play. There's an opportunity here. And that, but with just like, I mean, look, if we look back to 1997, 1998, when the people at E-Trade said, hey, you can now buy and sell shares of stock at McDonald's on the internet, most people thought they were crazy.
Yeah.
Everybody who was a stockbroker at that time said, no, none of my clients are ever going to leave me. They all love and trust my opinions. You know, look, fast forward even 5 years and the world had changed.
Yeah.
You know, I'd rather pay $9.95 for a trade than $99.95 for a trade. And so people moved to E-Trade and Schwab and other players because they were able to get real-time access to data they wanted in the way they wanted it, and they could execute the trades in trusted formats.
Yes.
Now what we're doing is we're just, with all of these markets, we've got new technology, new types of new investor classes, new investor companies, new kind of companies in the ecosystem, and new services have to be created. So there's a bit of uncertainty right now, but that's being figured out. And you can look at the UK, and you can see how those markets sort themselves and can then start growing.
But that is democracy in action.
Yes.
It's financial democracy. It's the ability for people to make their own decisions.
Yep. My whole thing, this whole thing for me is about creating more economic opportunity and jobs globally, because that's what I really believe is that's what this will do. Because ultimately, every new entrepreneur who creates a great service has to have the money to do it.
Absolutely.
And so fintech is going to touch everything.
And as time goes on, as people become more aware that, as we start seeing exits, I think that's the critical thing, because,
sure,
Title III is relatively new, but as you get more and more stories of people that have actually made money through these investments, which we're beginning to see with Regulation A+, but that's a much more compressed timeline. I think that's the important thing, is just to get the success stories out there. And particularly if the capital goes from $1 million to $5 million, then that opens up an entirely different sector. Because as you say, $1 million is, in some cases, it's too much. You know, it's a bit like the three bears with the porridge, So it would be a very exciting development. And then we have the backdrop of what's happening with cryptocurrencies, and who knows what's happening there. But there seems to be a global sea change in terms of the way that money moves from people that have it to people that want to do something with it. And so this layer of brokers and stuffy shirts and the local country club, in terms of ways, the way of getting access to these investments, I think that's gone forever.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it just opens up the opportunity for more people. And I think that it's an opportunity for you to demonstrate. Also, I mean, especially Title III or seed stage funding, the ability to, raise $500,000 from, your network, and the ability to then go out and execute against that with a couple of milestones enables you to then go on to more traditional sources of capital, as well as your crowd again, and go to your crowd again, and you're not ready to raise again, say, would you like to participate while they're also raising from more traditional sources, because you have those proof points. I mean, one of the companies that we advise is they're in stealth right now, but they've had this incredible, kind of business proposition in the fintech space. And they've gone to industry insiders in their network to raise a substantial amount of money through, you know, basically crowdfunding. And then when they're able to launch their product, can then go out at a much better valuation to professional investors.
Absolutely, that's right. And so that's, and it is the beginning, because I know from being an entrepreneur for a number of years, how absolutely, you know, impossible it seems just to get that movement from zero to one.
It's the hybridization of funding, right? It's hybridization.
And I think that's, you know, it's the fact that now, I mean, I know the legislation is 5 years old, but it's literally just, it is 15 months in. So you have this great expression where you say that we're a page 60 of a 1,000-page novel or a 1,000-page discourse. So is that something you still feel, or do you think the book is now 2,000 pages?
That's a good question. I think we're maybe at a page 100 now. But yeah, maybe it's a 1,500-page book at this point. I think that these tectonic forces don't shift overnight. And as much as I'd like them to move faster, there's just you know, limits on how, you know, this, the amount of information that people can process and actions they can take to act on that information. And that's what we're dealing with.
Well, that's the crowd for you.
Yes. Yeah, and it's also regulators, right? It's the fact that you've got these, the regulators, and this is not a disparaging comment. This is just, they've got a lot to deal with in a lot of different areas. And
well, their job is to regulate, exactly.
Their job is to regulate. And so you're seeing a lot of different regulators in different countries who are trying to make a mark and trying to expand their power and capacity, whether it be Singapore, Abu Dhabi, you know, other places, London, certainly, yeah. To use fintech and the sandbox approach to really be able to expand. Whereas in the U.S., I mean, the CFTC and the Comptroller of the Currency recently said, in kind of oblique ways, but pretty clearly, that we're not going to do a regulatory sandbox in the U.S.
Yeah,
because we're the biggest market in the world, and we don't need that. And so, and certainly, you know, any conversation I've had in D.C. has reflected that. And so, it's just a slower, more conservative approach. But I think that, again, for regulators who are ready to innovate, regulators who want to create some heat and light, and also in a controlled way, it's a great opportunity.
It is, and again, as you said earlier, the great thing is that this is not US centric. I mean, the movement is global now. So, you know, there's money flowing from investors in one side of the planet to target companies the other side of the planet. So the technology is there. So it's exciting times, as they say.
Indeed.
But talking of exciting times, now is the most exciting time you're going to have in your life, because I'm going to ask you this question. As you realize your entire existence is really just peaked at this precise moment.
I'm ready.
I don't mean to over-egg it here slightly. So this is the questionnaire that I borrowed from James Lipton of Inside the Actor's Studio. Every day I think I'm going to get an email from him saying, you know, please cease and desist. But I think he
borrowed it from someone else before. So
exactly. So and that guy is like died in 1922. So I think they're probably. But anyway, the first question is: what is your favorite word?
Yes.
And what is your least favorite word?
Won't.
Won't. Very powerful. What are you most...
It's different than can't.
I know, because can't is one. Won't is more, I can't be bothered to listen to you. I want to have my lunch. And you're asking me too much and I need to go home. Yeah. Well, my coffee's getting cold. So my third question is, what are you most excited about right now?
Fintech entrepreneurs around the world.
Fantastic. And what turns you off right now?
I just think the inability to listen. The inability to have a conversation, an exchange of true ideas, right? Because there's a way to have a conversation where people can, sorry for the long answer, but there's conversation and there's shouting at each other, which is what we see on television a lot with commentators. And I think that, you know, that's what we need more of, is true conversation.
What are they saying? Hell is the impossibility of reason. I think I saw that on a movie somewhere, actually. Something like that, where I get what you're saying. What sound or noise do you love?
Ocean waves.
And what sound or noise do you hate?
Jackhammer.
Oh, well, yeah. Yeah, that's very close to my heart. What is your favorite curse word?
Son of a bitch.
That's brilliant. That's all one word, by the way. Because that, again,
that's how we say it in the South.
It's an incredibly flexible and very, very demonstrable word. So, what profession other than your own would you like to attempt?
Chef.
Ah. And what profession would you not like to attempt?
Skydiver.
Okay. Yeah, I can see that sort of, you know, the sense of self-preservation coming to the... And my final question then, Jason, is if heaven exists, what would you like to hear God say when you arrive at the pearly gates?
Well, you're extremely late, but we're happy you're here.
Fantastic. Yes. Go. Well, Jason, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on. And thank you so much for, you know, all of the insight into crowdfunding and how we're still at the beginning of something that's just going to grow and change everyone's lives for the better. And it's just been brilliant having you on.
Well, thank you so much for having me. And, you know, thanks for being a part of this, this great interview series.
Wonderful. Great. Well, look forward to talking to you again soon.
Take care.